fucking baby! Goo goo gaga! Shades on, leave me gone! Sure is quiet outside. Would be a shame if somebody had to blow some leaves. Help! All my neighbors!
It's 6 a.m. on a Saturday, you fuckwad! Is this really necessary?
No!
Then why are you doing it?
Because fuck you, that's why!
Good morning, Sweet World, and welcome to the No Dumbs Podcast on the Athletic Network. It's Tuesday, June 15th. I'm J.E. Skeets, rolling with the homie, Tass Mellis. What's up, Tass?
What's up, everybody?
Hey, we got my top shot hot boy, Trey Kirby.
Ayo!
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 The international man of mystery, taking it to the max. He forgot to even say ayo, because he's still laughing over a leaf blower clip. Lealis.
JD, I'm so glad. I've been waiting and waiting and waiting. A million people have sent that to us. I'm glad you pulled it out today. That's maybe my favorite cold open so far. That's incredible.
Wow, that's bold. That's bold. Yes. Last, not least, certainly making the magic happen, is JD.
Hello.
There he is. And here we are. Yeah, a lot of people tagging us in that clip on the social media channels. Thank you, thank you, thank you. That was good. I actually purposely didn't watch it. I was I thought it was about leaf blowers, and I was like, well, we're going to see this, so I'm not going to even click on it. And it was even better than I thought it was.
Shout out. Is that really necessary? No!
Shout out to the stream team for joining us live right now on YouTube. Smash that like button, leave your comments, and subscribe to No Dunks on YouTube if you haven't already. Keep sending in your questions and comments for the next Beach Step and Podcast. Email them in, nodunks@theathletic.com, or tweet them in, @NoDunksInc. We're hitting the beach tomorrow. So you still have a good day or so to get your cues and comments in. Tass, how's that batch looking for tomorrow's Beach Stepping Podcast? Do we need some bangers still from the people, or are we good?
No, we're good. We are good. Oh, the lawn has been mowed and trimmed and looking crispy. Leaf blower put away. Just sit back and relax and enjoy the show tomorrow.
Oh, let's get our leaf blowers out on the beach. Cause some havoc.
Throwing sand around?
Woo!
Might be the worst place you could have a leaf blower at the beach. Throwing sand in everybody's meals. You're chewing on granules for the rest of the day. Sign me up!
Yeah, if that means we're all going to wear goggles for our show tomorrow, protect our eyes, I'm down.
Okay.
Cool.
Finally, grab your No Dunks merch. Immaculate items available over at nodunks.com. We got hoodies, t-shirts, shorts. We got coffee mugs. Go grab your No Dunks gear over at nodunks.com. All right, fun show lined up today. We're going to have Tim Cato on today's pod to discuss his Athletic article on the Mavericks front office drama. This was making waves on Twitter yesterday. So much so, in fact, Mark Cuban just retweeted it with total bullshit. Whoa, Cubes! Oh my goodness. So we'll talk to Tim about this article and all of his reporting and what's going on there, sort of behind the scenes. We'll also run through the all-defensive teams. Those were announced on NBA TV last night. We'll look ahead to tonight's pivotal Game 5 in Brooklyn. Some late-breaking news that James Harden has been upgraded to doubtful for this one. Kyrie's a no-go in Game 5. Harden, doubtful, maybe is going to play in this. We'll see. But let's start by recapping last night's games. First game was fantastic. Trae Young leading the Hawks. Ka-ka! And a rally to get past the Sixers late in the fourth there with Embiid hurting Tass. Rough second half for him, but let's get into it. The Hawks tie this thing up at 2 games apiece. What are your big takeaways?
Yeah, Hawks down double digits at half, and then were able to fight back mainly because Joel Embiid couldn't hit a shot. I think we got to start there because Joel Embiid, runner-up for MVP, looked like, I can't even describe what he looked like, really. He was just forcing every shot that came his way. He was looking for fouls. He ended 0 for 12 in the second half. He just couldn't find the rim whatsoever, and this still was a really, really tight game down the stretch. Last few minutes, co-All-Star Ben Simmons didn't shoot in the last few minutes, and Tobias Harris, their other sort of supposed to be their the guy who is able to penetrate and score when those guys don't do it. He didn't take a shot the last few minutes, and yeah, the Hawks were able to overcome. I think if Joel Embiid hits one stinky shot, then the Sixers probably win this game. He just kept forcing it and forcing it and forcing it. He looked such like a different player. It sort of reminded me of 2019. The Sixers went to 7 games with the Toronto Raptors, and before every game, Embiid was listed as questionable because he had an illness. It was really strange. It was game after game after game. He had this illness, supposed illness where he was hurt, but what illness, you know, lasts for days on days on days. And he came out and he had, this sort of impactful series because he is impactful when he's on the floor, but he scored 11, 12, 13, 16, 17 in five of those games. And that's what this reminded me of. He obviously wasn't just sick 2 years ago. He was in pain. There was an injury. And coming into this series, the meniscus was slightly torn. I think it's starting to bother him as the series goes on. He said after the game that he's not going to be 100% this series. And I think that's what the Hawks have going for them in this series. If Embiid is going to face a little bit of pressure, you know, those doubles that come and he's going to get rid of the ball or he's going to force it. He's not looking good. The Hawks could, you know, stretch the series to seven games, and then we'll see there. I think the Sixers are still the favorite in this series because, as I said, if Joel Embiid hits one shot in the second half, if he's 2 for 12, I think they win this game. He goes 4 of 20. Now they go home, and everybody should be a little bit better there. But I think, you know, you got to think long term here, the prospects. And I'm sorry to talk about the Sixers first, but again, they go into Atlanta. It's a one possession game with their MVP runner-up looking the way he did, where he's obviously not right. Something going on there, you know, the knee. It just could be that body not being able to hold up over an entire season. And that was the question for Joel Embiid coming into this playoffs. He's never had to carry a team this way. He just hasn't. 2 years ago, he had Jimmy Butler beside him. Last year, you know, they were out in the first round with Ben Simmons out. This is new territory for him. There was a reason the Sixers signed him to that contract where he didn't get paid if he had injuries in his legs because he's had those for a long time, and it just seems like it's catching up to him right now. So let's go to the Hawks. You know, I'm done railing on Joel Embiid because the Hawks did play a good game, but I do think you got to start with the MVP runner-up not looking like that.
Yeah, I thought he was going to puke. I tweeted that. He looked so either fatigued or in pain or a combo of both, Trey. I'm talking about Embiid, of course, in that second half. He went to the locker room in the second quarter, right? And, you know, you're like, uh-oh, that's never a good sign, but that happens a lot with him. But then he came out and hit some big shot. He had that beautiful, like, turnaround, hit a three, and you're like, okay. And then, yeah, just going the 0 for 12. And there was a part where he was at the free throw line, Lee. He was, like, trying to buy time at the free throw line. Like, he was doing, like, that walking around in the paint, like, just almost, like, to get his wind or to feel a little bit better. I don't know. And, you know, he didn't really explain much after the game outside of, like, well, yeah, I've got something wrong with my knee, but, you know, whatever. The sort of, like, no excuses, I can be better, we got to be better. But, yeah, what a comeback. They were up 18. This looked like it was over. And if they win that game, it looks like the series is over, probably in five back in Philly, and suddenly it's 2-2. But, yeah, let's put Embiid aside for a second. The Hawks comeback. Who impressed you most in that second half rally, Lily?
John Collins. I thought he had some really, really special moments in that second half, and really impactful ones as well, because he had two huge putback dunks. And if you watch those, just how far he came from, both times he started on the three-point line and the Sixers simply didn't pay attention to him. Mm-hmm. And he got those dunks. And those are those sort of like life-injecting plays. You know, the crowd gets into it. His teammates get into it. And then later on, he had a huge block on Tobias Harris, which would have made it a six-point game because Tobias Harris was going for a dunk. And for a team that had really been struggling with their offense, that's the sort of easy basket they were hoping to get. But he couldn't do that. And John Collins was all right there for that one. But the biggest play, I think, was a crucial offensive rebound, about 220 to go. They're down by four, the Hawks. He keeps the possession alive. Really good hustle offensive rebound. Then he goes to the corner. They find him. I think it's Trae Young drills him in the corner, and he hits that three, and it brings him back to within one. And then even on that last play, where Joel Embiid was a really well-designed play, I thought, from Doc Rivers. Joel Embiid goes in. We know he's struggling. Gets a high percentage look going to the basket. And John Collins comes over. Doesn't touch the ball, but his presence is there, and he's just up there contesting a shot. So, yeah, Trae Young, no question, he was a star. Hit some floaters. Had 18 assists in this game, which was a little surprising. But I actually thought John Collins's impact on this game at crucial times was huge for them, because they got looks in that fourth quarter. This game, you know, it was close and both teams sort of struggled, but Gallinari had a wide open shot. Bogdanovich missed one. Trae Young had one of his, deep threes that rimmed out. Then he was hunting for a foul. That one missed out as well. So the Hawks themselves could have almost put this one a little bit more distance, but they couldn't sort of take the advantage there. But I thought in some really crucial moments. John Collins was just fantastic for his team last night and really had had his fingerprints all over that fourth quarter.
Oh my God, yeah. I was actually pissed off with John Collins because we talked about us going down to the Fortress for game three, and man, were they missing something like that in that game three in that second half when they were down. Like any sort of like big dunk, big block, you know, something to get the crowd going, some energy, because that stuff's infectious.
Oh,
and
yeah.
You're right. Instead of game three, it happened here in game four, probably saving the Hawks season. 14 and 12 for Collins, and you went through all the big plays there, Lee, perfectly. Trey, what did you see in this one? You know, I'm sure you would applaud Collins for bringing some energy there, but you perked up when Lee dropped Ice Trey there and his 18 assists, because he didn't shoot the ball that well, but man, was he setting up guys.
Yeah, 18 assists, and the huge other number to me was that the Hawks only had 4 turnovers as a team. That's pretty incredible, because I thought the only way that the Hawks are going to be able to beat the Sixers again in this series is if they shoot the shit out of the ball, and, you know, they shot the ball fine last night, but I think they only ended up making, 12 three-pointers? Like, that's not a crazy number of three-pointers. They shot 30% from three, but Trae Young was just finding anybody who was open. They were getting some buckets, and yeah, Collins's energy in the third quarter into the fourth quarter was infectious is exactly the right word, and it even saved the night for Skeets. I thought you came through with a humongously great tweet of JC saving the Hawks, you know, because the Pope had an MLK jersey early in the season, and I thought that was great because earlier in the night you were saying, man, good thing we didn't go down to the Fortress tonight.
Oh God, that first start of this game was brutal.
Wish this one here, Skeets. You got to remember that the first half leads. It's not just the first half. You got to play the second half here. But yeah, I thought the Embiid stuff was very weird. 0 for 12 in the second half. And like you're saying, Tass, it just felt like he was trying to go to the free throw line the whole time. I even think that last miss, the lane is basically there for Embiid, right? He should have dunked it. That should have been a dunk. And that probably is a dunk in April or, you know, whenever Joel Embiid is feeling his healthiest. That was a lot like Patrick Ewing missing in Game 7, 1995, had a wide-open finger roll. He bricked it off, and obviously the Knicks didn't win that series. Same thing with Embiid. Like, that should have been a bucket. He was open, man. Like, and that's a bucket for most of the season for Embiid, but he just didn't have the legs. He didn't have the explosion. He said he didn't have it going. He knew in the first half. The stuff with Elton Brand was pretty weird because, like you're saying, Embiid went back to the locker room in the second quarter. Stephanie Reddy seemed to be worried, but she tracked down Elton Brand and saw him smiling behind his mask, and apparently everything was all good, except as we saw in the second half, not everything was all good. 0 for 12. So why didn't Tobias Harris shoot the ball at all in the fourth quarter? 2 attempts. I would have liked to see him try and get something going, since we knew Embiid was just flailing out there trying to go to the line.
Yeah, that was very puzzling to see who was getting the shots in the fourth quarter. And yeah, Simmons didn't shoot the last few minutes. The shots went to Seth Curry and Furkan Korkmaz around Joel Embiid, who, was looking to get to the line, I guess, to rest because he knew his legs weren't there. He was just trying to get superstar MVP runner-up type calls, you know? Like, I think that's what it was. His legs aren't right. It was just strange to go from a decent first half and then the legs just went, something just went, you know, went from 4 of 8 in the first half to 0 of 12 in the second half. But that is similar to what we have seen in the past. Tobias just needed to step up. And then the Joel Embiid story isn't as much of a story in this one at all. Him and Simmons just kind of disappeared in that fourth quarter offense-wise.
What do you think of Simmons not even being on the floor at the end there, Lili, when they're down three, you know, you got to push it. That is the fastest guy you've got on your team, obviously the most athletic. I guess the concern is, well, Nate McMillan might just say wrap him up, and they need a three. I mean, that's already a strategy, and especially maybe even more so with it Simmons. But what did you think of that? I get it if you're thinking McMillan's going to wrap him up and foul him, and then you have no chance probably, but, oh, man, you would have liked him pushing it instead of Shake Milton, we'll tell you that.
Yeah, for sure. And Simmons for the free throw line, that's obviously where he struggled. He went 1 for 5 again there last night, and the look on his face was kind of like, man, this is I don't want to be here. I don't want to be pulled off the court because I can't make my free throws. But Doc Rivers, I think, was like, we can't afford to have him get fouled either because he's just not being able to knock down free throws and he needs to improve in that area. So it's a huge call for the coach to say to your best or second best player, you can't be on the court on offense.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes you see sometimes guys who are not great defensively get subbed out. But for a guy to not be on there offensively is bad, because you think Simmons is like, well, if I get the ball, I'm going to attack and try to get to the lane. But the Hawks are like, if you come in, you're getting fouled. You're going to the free throw line. And Doc Rivers just didn't want to basically see his player go to the free throw line and clunk at least one of those free throws, because that's, I think, what Doc Rivers was thinking. And I think the Sixers probably got a little complacent in this game too. When they built that first half lead, it was huge. And it was like the series is basically, it felt like it was a series ending game last night, even though it would have only been 3-1. Mm-hmm. And they came out in that second half and they were flat and their energy was off. And of course it started there with Embiid. But yeah, that is... That's not a good look for Ben Simmons, that he can't be on the court in that crucial moment in a potential, you know, series swinging game like that. He's on the bench because he can't hit his free throws.
He was so good in game three and so aggressive in game three that it really stands out when he's not. And I think that's a huge reason that Trae Young had 18 assists last night, too. Like, he wasn't feeling the defense as much as he had in games two and three, which was the huge change for the Sixers, putting Ben Simmons on. And then the size was bothering Trae Young, but he was just masterful last night, operating and finding all of the open shooters and the open players for dunks. He had some great alley-oops. It was just great stuff from Trae Young. But Ben Simmons honestly made it easy on him by not playing as hard as he can, not playing as well as he did in games two and three.
Yeah, Young was amazing down the stretch. He either scored or assisted on the Hawks' final 15 points. And instrumental in that 7-0 run there in the final couple of minutes. That pass to Collins where he went in, drew all the defenders, and then just whipped that wraparound dime to the corner was, oh my God, chef's kiss, Lee. I don't know if that very solid play, is that too sexy? It's a little bit of both, but he was awesome. I mean, yeah, back to the Sixers over a second, though. Simmons and Harris definitely let down Embiid last night. Like, he's been a monster the entire series. I don't know what the hell happened, if the knee flared up, again, just pure exhaustion, something else going off the floor. I don't know with Embiid, but he obviously wasn't himself. We're all agreeing with that. That's when you need your secondary, third guys, your other sort of like all-stars or borderline all-stars to like, come on, step up, carry the load here, help him out. He's done all the heavy lifting for the rest of this thing. And they didn't in both of those guys. I think Simmons and Harris are to blame for their no-shows there in supporting Embiid tasks. I don't know what you think of that.
Yeah, definitely. The good thing is from the Hawks' perspective is that Trae Young still hasn't found his shot that he lost after game one. I mean, he's just been a little bit... You know, Ice Trae has been a little ice cold. You know, he couldn't find his shot. So, yeah, setting guys up, doing what he could to make this a Hawks victory. But, you know, he missed 18 of his 26 shots. So that's something that he goes, you know, into Philly with and thinks, you know, if I find my flow a little bit, he's probably going to look for his a little bit at the beginning of the game to be able to help his guys in a different way in the fourth quarter. He's got to get hot to win on the road. He's got to be... a better shooter. And so that's a positive for the Atlanta Hawks, even though, you know, this one went down to the wire. It was like a game of attrition out there, that 23-18 fourth quarter, who is just going to make enough shots. And he did what he had to do to give his team the W. That's for sure. Got everybody involved out there. And it was great for them, I think, just like an emotional boost to get John Collins going, because it has been Trae and the Bogdan show for much of this playoffs and this series. And the Kevin Huerter insertion to the starting lineup, finally it happened over Solomon Hill. And now they've got guys feeling good anyways. And if Trae can find his shots, then they definitely have a chance in Philly.
So a few questions and notes before we move on to the other game. Lee, I got to ask you, and I don't want us to get us fighting again, because that really upsets people when mom and dad fight. But Ben Simmons called for a flagrant one foul on Collins there on the sort of the breakaway jam. Came in pretty hot, and he got the flagrant one with about 3 minutes to go in the third quarter. How do you feel about that one and the official, especially involving an Australian that you like?
Oh, that's it. I'm biased. Anything Australians do is always perfect. Yeah. They're right. I've never criticized an Australian ever. I think they got the call right again. I think it was a hard play or foul. Simmons was going to stop him from getting a dunk or a layup or whatever. Yep. Now, he got it just right. If Collins is in the air, there's no question that's a flagrant too, if you take a guy out when he's elevated, but he gets him just as he's still on the ground there. It was
did
a good
you notice what he did immediately after the foul?
Yeah,
though,
yeah,
too?
Yeah. He went over to him, and John Collins acknowledged that as well. Hey, yeah, and that, you know, I think there's just such a difference zone between those two fouls. One is a legit, hard, fair playoff foul. You know, like the guy was just saying, I'm not giving you a layup here, and I think that's the big difference. This is not the other end of the court. Mm-hmm. You know, so I didn't have any problem.
Another point I was making with Jokic is he didn't do himself any favors after the hard foul.
Yeah, possibly.
If he approaches it a little differently, I think he maybe stays in that game. But anyway. Yeah.
But I don't think, I certainly didn't see anyone thinking that was a flagrant two last night. I think the referees, I think everyone sort of acknowledged, like, you know, there's no easy baskets in a tight playoff game like that. Simmons got him. He acknowledged it. He didn't try to act as if he wasn't trying to foul him. He got him. And Colin stayed on his feet as well. So it wasn't like he whacked him and sent him sprawling into the crowd. So I thought they got that call right.
Mm. Must have been a good apology, too, because I thought John Collins still wanted to throw down. When he got up, he was pretty angry.
Yeah.
But then Ben Simmons was like, hey, man, I didn't mean it. He's like, okay. All right. Nice. Maybe that was Ben Simmons' best move last night, because he was very aggressive going for that that flagrant foul and then a very aggressive apology, and maybe that saved him an ejection. I don't know what happened. But, yeah, that was a flagrant one. He smacked him. But it's weird because... I don't know. That does feel like a little bit more of a dangerous play to me. Body checking a guy who's going up for a layup rather than just smacking at a ball on the other side of the court. But I don't know. Thought they should have both been flagrant ones. But I don't know. It was that's kind of when you knew that the Hawks were looking good, because it felt like the Philadelphia 76ers were a little bit rattled on that play.
Yeah, it's still a big part of it is all about the landing and what happens.
Yeah.
You know, after the hit, that's always the case with these extracurriculars. If John Collins, you know, does more than just a double axel and lands perfectly on his foot, like if he actually hits the deck,
shout out to Brian
Orser. Totally different. We're still shutting out Brian Orser 30 years ago.
I love to shout out Brian Orser, 88 Calgary Olympics. Hell yeah, man.
Yeah, if he falls flat like a figure skater who's fallen flat on his face before. You got one of those skates?
Well, I mean, no. The thing, if once you say Brian Orser, who's the other Brian that immediately comes to mind?
Botana.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes, gold medal winner. Yes. Mm-hmm. Falling flat on your face. I don't know. Did Elvis Stoichel ever come up short? In a,
yeah,
in
he
a
was
men's
small.
Final. Yeah.
He was.
Yeah, he was pretty impressive, though. Anyway, I think they got it right. We're all agreeing with that with the flagrant one. Lee, have you looked into Game 6 tickets? I was tweeting at you, SRO, are we going back down to the Fortune? By all accounts, that was maybe like the loudest the Atlanta Arena had ever been. I saw some people like Neek Bird days, and like when the Celtics and Hawks got into it in a series with like Zaza Pachulia was involved, I think, against like a Garnett. Like that's when it was popping off too. But it was loud on the broadcast, and we knew people that were there last night. They were like, that building was going insane. Again, I'm just like pissed off we went to game 3 instead of game 4, because it did seem like obviously a much more entertaining game and the crowd was going crazy. But what is game 6 looking like?
No standing rooms on sale yet, but they usually don't go on until a little bit later. But listen, there's a watch party. Do you want to go down and watch game 5 down the Fortress?
Well,
nah, I don't want to do that.
No.
So we'll see. Yeah, but Friday night again, that's perfect. That's the perfect night for watching basketball. So,
Friday night, the perfect night for watching basketball. Why is it better than any other night?
Because everyone's the end of the week. Everyone's excited. It's a great 7:30 tip-off. It's the weekend coming. You know, you can always... it's not a school night, you know? I mean, it's like school's out right now anyway, but it's just a great night to go down, and everyone's having fun. Wasn't it a great night, even though they lost?
Friday night for the show, too, means you don't have to be taking notes while you're watching the game.
Yeah,
you can just have your big tall boy there. What were you drinking? A Modelo? I can't remember what you were drinking.
Peroni. You guys on the Peronis, too. You dumped that other Michelob or whatever that trash was. You got into the Peronis.
Modelo, my friend.
Oh, yeah, Modelo. Okay, Modelo's okay. It's okay. As long as it's not Bud.
But that's a classic Lee Ellis. Again, like, the bar is like 1 foot from us. Goes over to it. Do you have any Peroni? No. Oh, okay, I'm not going to get a Modelo.
You started drinking Peroni, though.
You went and got it. Yeah, it was fantastic.
No, I didn't.
Oh, who
Tass got it?
It
for you?
Oh, Tass, thank you, man. Thanks for that Peroni.
Micro bubbles. Everybody loves a micro bubble.
Mm. Well, they're, you know, all beer at an arena is, I was going to say, fantastic, but it's just overpriced.
What we do have to do, though, is get there early, because standing room, that plum spot was already taken when we got, you guys were there like 45 minutes before tip-off, and there was already a couple of bros there, so we've got to get there early.
Okay.
I was there 90 minutes before tip-off, but I was taking in the scenes. There's a lineup outside the arena 90 minutes before tip-off. That's how either one... Hawks fans are excited for basketball, or two, people just need things to do. Like stand outside an arena. I haven't stood outside an arena in like a year and a half. I'm going to go hang outside the Hawks.
Good. All right, game six, down at the Fortress. We know we're getting that at the very least. Okay, let's go to the other game from last night. Kawhi and Paul George each scored 31. Clippers tied this series with the Jazz. Two games apiece. Lili, this one was, I mean, look, it felt over at the half, if we're being honest, especially after the Kawhi dunk. Jazz, what, they get as close as, I don't know, 13 maybe? It never felt like the Clippers were in trouble. Yeah. But what were your takeaways from this?
Well, yeah, you say the first half. I mean, often in the NBA, the first quarter is sort of the least important. But last night's game was pretty much over after that first quarter. And I think this was an even more decisive victory than Game 3. Basically a continuation from that, where the Clippers pulled away in the fourth. This time, they just destroyed the Jazz in that first quarter. And Quinn Snyder went, Greg Popovich called his first timeout 2 minutes into the game. And even then, you could sort of feel like the Jazz are just not ready for this game. They just didn't bring the energy. And even when he did call that timeout, it got out to 29 points in the second quarter. That is just an embarrassment for the Jazz. You know, for a team that's got fantastic offense and a fantastic defense, just giving up everything at one end and not being able to score at the other was really bad. And it was the Clippers stars who led the way again. And I'll get to Kawhi in just a sec because he was brilliant. But for all the slander Playoff P has gotten, he's been awesome in the last two games, and really the last three. He had a bit of a bad shooting night in game one, but the last three games he's been much better. And last night, 31 points on really efficient shooting, hit the threes, got to the line, and I just thought he took really smart shots. The threes, when they were open off a screen, he took those. Mid-ranges, if they were there, and he sort of slithers into the lane the way that he does that and opens up. And look, Joe Ingles, again, I'm going to have to say something bad about an Australian who shot, believe it or not. Joe Ingles, we know, you know, loves to play the mental games there with Paul George and get into his head. But physically, he's way too slow to guard him on the perimeter. And a couple of times, Paul George has said, OK, I'm just going into lane. You know, like we saw with Trae Young on Danny Green in the first game of the Sixers series, he just walks past and then he can decide, OK, I've got a mid-ranger here. Or he was passing the ball really well last night. But either way, he kind of got whatever he wanted.
Right.
And then Kawhi, you know, who was defended well by Bogdanovich in the first two games, he's basically decided since then, listen, I'm much better as an offensive player than he is and whatever the Jazz are throwing at me defensively, because O'Neal had a go at him last night, Clarkson and Bogdanovich got some time on as well. He's deciding, right, I can beat this perimeter defender and get to that mid-range if I want it before Gobert or Favors can come out, and so he gets a pretty much uncontested shot there. Or he was stepping back, hitting the three, and he also got to the free throw line 14 times, I think it was, last night. Paul George and Kawhi Leonard are in control of this series right now. I mean, the Jazz remain favorite because they have home court advantage here, but I've seen the two stars really step up. And again, a lot of credit has to go to those two, but also Ty Lue. They've been down 0-2 in their first round series. They got out of that. They were down 0-2 in this series. And now they've kind of swung momentum their way. Game five is massive in this series. And if you're
pivotal, I would say pivotal. Yeah.
Some would say that, yeah. But if you're the Clippers, you've got to feel like
pivotal.
We have kind of found a way here to penetrate and break down this offense. This defense from the Jazz. They gave up 132 points in game three, and then last night I think it was only 116, but it was way more meaningful in the sense that this game was certainly over by halftime if it wasn't over by the first quarter. So I have to say I've been really impressed with what the Clippers have done, and Ty Lue basically said, these are my eight or nine guys I'm going with and that's it. And he's sort of coached this team well to get back into this position after again being down 0-2 in a series.
Yeah, Tass, what do you think? How badly do the Jazz need a guy like Mike Conley back in the mix here? And I don't know what his status is for Game 5 or moving forward in this series, but they could use a little jolt there to help out Mitchell right now.
Yeah, no doubt. They need another ball handler because the Clippers are ready to guard. If you just watch them, especially now that they've gone with essentially a point guard and four wings out there, no center to start, they are ready to switch. I don't think there's a team that talks more on defense. They are chatties out there because they're switching everything, and that's really taking Rudy Gobert out of the way, out of the game offensively. He had 1 point midway through the third quarter, but he's not going to take anybody down low and dominate them. And then he got it going a little bit with the pick and roll from Joe Ingles that they just kind of found a little bit. They need to go inside with this switching defense that is in front of everybody. They're doing a really, really good job, and they're taking away those twos because they're so quick. This is a game that the Jazz win the three-point battle. They hit more threes, but the Clippers are doing such a good job of taking away everything inside, really helping on Donovan Mitchell, even though Donovan Mitchell got his again because he is that talented. But, yeah, the kudos got to go to Ty Lue for deciding that, you know, we can win with Reggie Jackson at the point, and then, you know, four switchers in Kawhi, Paul George, Marcus Morris, and Nikola Batum, yep, who have no problem stepping up and hitting big shots. They are all stepping into their shots, and yeah, 118 points may not have been enough to beat a regular season Jazz team, but when you're playing defense like this and you get you know, multiple threes from Marcus Morris, and then the bench comes through the way it's coming through, the Clippers, yeah, I think they're the favorite. Even though they're on the road, they're playing like the better team, no doubt. Yeah, they desperately need Conley to just to break up that defense and to be able to get to the rim.
Yeah, Clippers have been in control of this series basically since the second half of game two, even though the Jazz got the win. It was more stake for the Clippers last night, and yeah, kudos to Ty Lue, but honestly, kudos to Kawhi Leonard and Paul George. Back-to-back games with both of them having 30. Then, like you're saying, Tass, you throw in five threes from Marcus Morris, a pretty solid shooting performance from the Clippers, all things considered. You can't give up all three. That's what I said after game three. You can't have a 30-point game, a 30-point game, and good shooting from the role players. I was told the Jazz were a good defensive team, but this is looking easy for the Clippers right now because Kawhi Leonard has taken it to another level. Another massive dunk last night.
Oh,
so big of a dunk that Joel Embiid saw it in his press conference and couldn't resist commenting on it. But Kawhi Leonard doesn't have social media, so Ivica Zubats had to tell him about Joel Embiid seeing his dunk during his press conference. Everything's getting around. Kawhi now has probably the two best dunks in the postseason, both after being down 0-2. Well, I guess the second one, I guess it was game two against the Mavericks that he had his first dunk on Kleba. But yeah, Kawhi looks like he has really turned it into Terminator mode right here. You know, Bogdanovich had some success in games one and two of this series, and that has not been the case at this point. Jazz got to score inside. I'm with you, Tass. They got to do something besides just shoot three-pointers and rely on Donovan Mitchell here. I would have liked to see a little bit more Ingles and Gobert in the pick and roll, but like you're saying, Lee, Paul George was kind of torching Joe Ingles, so I don't know where you're at. Conley helps big time. Moves Jordan Clarkson down a little bit in the pecking order. Somebody else who can get the drive and kicks going. But yeah, the Clippers, shout out to Alex Wong. When the Clippers get down 0-2, they turn into the 96 Bulls for whatever reason. They're suddenly amazing. Maybe this was the key. They should have never got up 3-1 last year.
Mm. Yeah, and just Morris, back to him. He is a massive X factor for the Clippers and in these playoffs. He's 16 of 27, so 60% basically on three-pointers during the wins for the Clips. And then 7 of 33 from downtown, 21% in the five losses. It sure helps, like, when all eyes are on the two stars in PG and Kawhi, to have a guy out there like him that can, he can catch fire. And then he starts letting it go. When he sees one or two go in, Lee, that guy's like, I'm shooting the next one. And fair on him, because he's a bit of a streaky shooter that way. So he's a huge X factor then. Good win. This one's tied at two games apiece, just like the Hawks Sixers series. And yeah, we'll see what happens with Conley. You're right, TK. They could use him driving in there. The little floater game that we know he loves, it can hit. And then just setting guys up too. And defensively, Mike Conley, you know, mm-hmm, at 100% health, at least, is fantastic on the perimeter, and they could use some of that right now. So we will see. Okay, we got to get to our guests. Let's take a quick break, though, to hear from our sponsors.
Danielle has taken up painting. Oil painting, acrylic painting, other painting. I don't know what it is, but it's just incredible. If I can convince her to open up a Shopify store, I know she'll be hearing the... Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, yeah, just do it, to the first real life store stage, see, you made a sale, all the way to the did we just hit a million order stage? How about that? Shopify is there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap, offering outdoor outfits, or paintings, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From the all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S., and Shopify is the global force behind millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Here's some information. Just like entrepreneur David Scott Martin of Antique Candle did for No Dunks on Shopify. How about that? And sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, your AI-powered all-star.
Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/nodunks, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/nodunks now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/nodunks.
All right, let's bring in today's guest. We've kept him waiting long enough. Tim Cato is a staff writer for The Athletic covering the Dallas Mavericks. Tim, what's up, man? Thanks for joining us.
Hey, fellas. How are you?
We're fantastic. Good. The Mavs, Luka Doncic, yourself, all trending on Twitter yesterday due to a stellar piece written by you and our colleague Sam Amick concerning a potential rift within the Mavericks front office. It's titled Inside the Mavericks Front Office. Mark Cuban's shadow GM is causing a rift with Luka Doncic. What a headline. Shout out to the Athletic headline writers for that one. Highly recommend everybody listening and joining us live in the stream team, seek this article out. Go to theathletic.com/nodunks to get your subscription for The Athletic if you don't have one, and check this out. So, Tim, this made waves yesterday, and I just want to know, first off, like, when and sort of how did this story start coming together? Like, when did the reporting start on this for you?
Yeah, it's something I've been hearing about for months now, to be honest. It's definitely something that I knew, you know, it felt like the summer was when it was going to reach an inflection point and kind of a, you know, that this stuff was going to, you know, all the dynamics and the through lines of the front office, you know, we're going to come to a head. Mm-hmm. And, you know, no matter what I wrote or otherwise, someone asked me, I thought, a really intuitive question yesterday. And it's like, would we still be talking about this if the Mavericks, who had that lead in game three, were close to pushing off the Clippers? You know, if things had just gone slightly different on the game, would we still be talking about this story? You know, if they had gone on and advanced to the second round? Yeah, I think we would. I'm almost certain we would. You know, it's all stuff that I'd heard and been working on and hearing before that. So that's kind of the process, and I'll apologize for my, like, Tatooine-looking space station video. I'm on a backup laptop. Had a laptop malfunction last week that was poorly timed, to say the least.
That's, I thought you were going to say your laptop exploded after your Twitter mentions caught on fire yesterday. What's the fallout been like for you after the article came out?
Yeah, I mean, people are going to say what they say. You know, I've, you know, the sourcing of the story is there, and people should go read it. The one thing that, you know, I've kind of gone back to is that you can look at what happened in Game 7 against the Clippers when Luka Doncic, and, you know, he had, what, 46 points and 14 assists. And you don't need reporting to look at this, you know, look at the game not being competitive in the final minute, mm-hmm. and say that's an indictment on the front office. You know, you don't need reporting to look back over the last 10 decades of the Mavericks and say that's also an indictment on the front office. And there's clearly, you know, something going on there that the team isn't functioning well enough. And you also, I don't think, need reporting to look at Luka and to think that he is a superstar in the NBA, and in the NBA, superstars want to win. And, you know, that's kind of what the reporting says in the story, is that his long-term desire, his current desire, is to remain in Dallas long-term. But that could change if the team doesn't start winning. Mm-hmm. And we know how much Luka has won throughout his career. He's happy right now. He's going to sign the Supermax extension. That's what leak sources, you know, have told me, and I write it in the article. That said, the clock is ticking, and, you know, it's something that you have to pay attention to. And the time to figure out whatever is wrong or not working in the front offices now.
Tim, you got a lot of engagement on it. Fair enough, too. It was a great article. But the biggest retweet was from the biggest name and the biggest voice there in the Mavericks front office, Mark Cuban. I mean, what's your relationship like? Did you let him know this article was coming? Did he have some idea it was going to be there? And did you? I know you reached out to Harlebob for comment. Did you reach out to Mark Cuban as well prior to printing?
Yeah, you know, it's the typical way that people reach out for stories like this is to do it the morning of. I gave him a few hours. It's you know, I did get a comment from him, you know, and ultimately he declined comment otherwise. But you know, it's he's someone I've talked to, and you know, other than that, we'll leave it there.
At the center, I mean, of this rift, this controversy is Lee mentioned him there, Bob Vulgaris. Now, he's the Mavs Director of Quantitative Research and Development. NBA sickos out there or Twitter nerds will know him from probably back in the day where he was pretty active on Twitter. He was always on the Bill Simmons podcast. He was a professional gambler, made a lot of money in betting on the NBA and sort of putting pumping money into figuring out how to bet, I guess is the best way to put it. And, you know, within this article, Tim, you point out that he's become like an influential voice. So how did that sort of become about, how did that happen? And why is he sort of at the center of all of this between of maybe his relationship with the players, mainly Luka, and even Rick Carlisle, which I think is a fascinating part of this this article, where it's like maybe he's like almost dictating, you know, lineups and who should play and stuff like that. But he is the, you know, the center piece of this article, is he not, Vulgaris, and sort of how he deals with the within the organization?
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously he is, you know, he's in the headline. You know, if you put Shadow GM in there, that's where a lot of the focus is going to go. I knew that. In some ways, I view him as a character who shows, you know, these competing interests in the front office, and shows that, you know, as one anonymous source says, we had two GMs. And to me, in some ways, I even see that as the primary takeaway from the story. But it's definitely true that, you know, a lot of the details I have and were aware, you know, this would be, you know, how it's received are focused around Bob. And it's clear that, you know, he's someone who, you know, had a level of influence over Mark. He was someone he talked to, officially joined the team in 2018 when he was actually physically around and announced. But his, you know, over time, his style or his way of communication certainly wore on players for, you know, whatever, you know, there's two incidents with Luka that are talked about in the piece. But it's not either one of those alone that single-handedly, you know, spent their relationship or sent it spiraling. It had always already been something building from that. And, you know, there's sources that in the article that say that there's other players who have similar frustrations. And so, you know, all that, you know, paints a picture of someone who, you know, perhaps, you know, when a player looks at Rick Carlisle and rotations he's dictating, and when they see that as being, you know, something being dictated to him, yeah, that's going to be a problem in a locker room, and it's going to be something that affects the team. And so, you know, I think that's all in there. That's all in the story. And you know, I thought it was, you know, it's been an interesting process just kind of working through and reporting all the various aspects of it for sure.
So, Tim, Bob Vulgaris was hired in 2018 as the director of quantitative research and development. Two questions off that. His contract expires, you know, at the end of this season. Is part of the Luka requirement going forward as far as tinkering the front office that Vulgaris isn't rehired or re-signed? And the second thing, you know, I was very interested in these sort of analytical hires that are happening, these shiny hires that are happening where it's kind of unclear what these people are doing in the front office. Mark Cuban sort of hinted that there's a lot of artificial intelligence. There's a model that Bob Vulgaris developed. So the second question with Bob is, have you sort of understood better what he does exactly in the Mavs front office?
Yeah, I think for the first one, you know, there was a point, the second moment with Luka where he was upset he left, Luka was upset Bob left a game early. After that, Bob kind of stepped into a remote role that, you know, as far as it seemed or as far as I heard was valuable or had some level of value. I don't know what's going to happen this summer. I truly don't. It would be surprising to think that the almost shocking that the exact power structure and the way that the front office operates would continue to exist the same as it did before the season or over the past few seasons. But at the same time, this is a front office and a team just generally where tenures are very established. Donnie Nelson has been, you know, the longtime president of basketball operations. He's been in his role since 2005. And so in some ways, I don't think that it's wrong that the Mavericks would bring a new voice in some way. And I think that's what Bob was in a lot of ways. He was very analytically minded, you know, doing a lot of the same, as far as I understand it, doing a lot of the same work with that that you see even from blog posts in some ways when you're really looking at lineup data and matchup data, and then going further with second spectrum stuff and other things that aren't fully available even to the public. So, you know, as far as AI goes, that's beyond what I have a scope of. But, you know, I think generally the way the Mavericks have been more analytics focused, and you've even seen it in Carlisle, who's more willing to talk about this stuff over the past years. Famously, he was the guy who said the post-up is not a good play, talking about Kristaps Porzingis when inside the NBA criticized, you know, Porzingis for just not being a post-up player. So I think that all of this combined, you know, there's value. You know, this wasn't a piece specifically about how Bob came into a front office, that everything was going swimmingly. It's a bigger story than that. And I think the role he played had value. Clearly, it wasn't effective in the way that they brought it in and, you know, brought him in. And just generally that you know, there were clearly competing interests and power lines and through lines throughout this whole thing. So, you know, I think that's probably how I would kind of summarize how the whole situation went down. And I guess we'll just see what happens this summer.
Yeah, you talk about like in last year's draft, how Bob kind of made the two picks for them without even really consulting the rest of the team. Now, Luke is obviously a huge part here, but how much of an impact do you think it could have that other people within the organization could almost resign and say, listen, he's got too much power if I'm not going to be listened to, if I'm not going to be allowed to have my work respected? Because it sounds kind of like Bob was like, we're picking him, and those were the choices that were made, sort of overruling those other guys, the scouts and the other people and, you know, in the lower level there that make or do all the research and present that to Donnie or Mark or whoever it is. So do you feel that maybe some of those people could feel like, you know what, if they're not going to move on from Bob or not, you know, bring him back, then I'm going to go elsewhere and find work?
Yeah, I think that's an intuitive reading of things. How much Bob himself, his personality, the way he interacts with people, just specifically frustrated and rubbed and, you know, annoyed people over his tenure. I certainly heard, you know, from, you know, a lot of sources that was the case. I think the other reading of that is just what you said, that, you know, it's that if this person is taking more power and influence to the point that Mark Cuban is listening to him for draft picks when they have an entire scouting network, when they, you know, when they have a general manager, the team president, Donnie Nelson, who I think is relatively, you know, known for his draft prominence or pedigree or just expertise there. Mm-hmm. You know, I think both can be true, is that, you know, as one source in the story says, the most powerful person in the Mavericks organization is Mark Cuban, but the second most is whoever he's listening to. And so, mm-hmm. you know, there's a lot of competing interest and through lines and influences. And, you know, even still, like, I feel like, you know, I think the story does a good job showing the dynamics at play. But I feel like there's even, you know, it's quite possible there's even, you know, more layers to, you know, just how many people are trying to push one way or the other in this front office. And, you know, again, hopefully it's something we see this summer, whether it's through more reporting from me or others, or just kind of the team announcing new structures and stuff like that.
What do you think the Mavericks' number one priority is this offseason, Tim? I mean, either in the front office or even on the floor when it comes to players and guys that they should look to acquire and trying to build a team, an actual team that can go far around this, you know, what appears to be a generational superstar in Luka Doncic. What would you do? What if you're the Harlebob, Tim? You've got Cuban's ear. What are you telling him to do?
Well, if I'm Bob, then I just make AI figure it out for me.
I
mean, that seems like the
players. Oh, I like
that. Yeah, you know, in some ways, I think, you know, still the biggest question for the team is, you know, revolves around Kristaps Porzingis, actually. And he's someone who wasn't in the piece and it isn't, you know, somewhere my reporting led me throughout this process. But I think that's, you know, in many ways, the big question looming. And I don't think that they're going to get an answer to it this offseason. It's hard to see, you know, there even being viable trade partners out there if that's something they're looking to do. So, you know, there's clearly, you know, with the team losing twice in the past 2 years in the first round, you know, there are valuable, good players on this roster to surround Luka with, but there aren't enough of them. You know, I mentioned Game 7 earlier and just, you know, how much Luka did compared to how much the rest of the roster did. You know, clearly there needs to be talent upgrades and improvements. It's something that was talked about a lot. you know, at exit interviews when the team was wrapping up to head on vacation. You know, it's something Rick Carlisle talked about. It's something Donnie talked about. No Bob at that one. So sorry to report. But yeah, you know, I think just bringing more better talented players around Luka, you know, personally, I think the idea of a guard, a two-way guard who can play off the ball, but also still, you know, take the reins and take the load and the pressure off Luka does seem like a good idea. I don't know if he's at a point where he's ready to really share a backcourt, but I think someone like Kyle Lowry could certainly dictate that and you know, walk that line with someone like Luka.
Right.
It's something I'd look into. He's also, you know, a bit older. I'd have to think about what the price tag would be and just how that kind of meshes and morphs with all the other moves. Like, I think they also need to bring back Tim Hardaway Jr. Mm-hmm. I think at this point it'd be difficult not to do that, especially looking at what's available on this market. But yeah, I think those are two names, one on the team, one not, that makes some sense to me as you know, the Mavericks keep trying to build, you know, a more sustainable roster around Luka.
Do you feel like there's any sort of optimism at all amongst the Mavericks that, you know, Porzingis actually finished the season this year? He's gone out with a season-ending injury, I think, in every year of his career, except for this season. So theoretically, he'll have a chance to actually train rather than rehab over the summer. We've heard reports that maybe Luka and Kristaps aren't the best of buddies, but who cares, honestly, as long as you're able to produce on the court together. Do they still think that this matchup or this pairing of these two guys can work? Because, I mean, we all see it out there. Porzingis, the idea of Porzingis is a perfect fit with Doncic, right? But we just haven't seen it alongside Luka yet.
Yeah, I love the idea of Porzingis. I love the idea of what, you know, a unicorn can be, why he was promoted that way. I might be one of the few people still a little bit optimistic that it could work, but I think being more realistic, it's hard to look at that pairing and it's hard to look at the Mavericks' future and really expect and think that, okay, this is for sure going to be the duo. You know, in some ways it even feels like, you know, the best case scenario is Kristaps does come out really strong next season to the point that he builds up trade value, you know, so the team could go, you know, hopefully find someone with less questions lingering about his concerns. I think that the idea of Kristaps being a 7-3 Klay Thompson in a lot of ways where, you know, he is eliminating post-ups and he is eliminating even shot creation to a degree. You know, I think that's his best case scenario. And it's something that he can average 20, 22 points a game doing. You know, I think the one thing holding him back is that he's not the shooter Klay Thompson is. You know, mm-hmm. he has a perception of being a mm-hmm. great shooter. And I think Kristaps throughout his career has proven he's more of a good shooter. You know, you look at his percentages when he's wide open. You know, they're not like a lot of great shooters are like 45, 50%. He's more of a 40% guy, you know, when wide open. And then just generally, you know, has only pushed towards 40% on his, you know, on all of his three-pointers once in his career. And it was the shortened one when he tore his ACL in New York. So I think that's one concern with his offense, and the other one, of course, is defense, and that definitely slipped this year. But we saw him more active, more engaged, you know, even in the last few games of the season or of the playoff series. So I think if there is an optimistic take, that is the KP, that is the player, you know, kind of this 7-3 player who is literally playing like a shooting guard in a lot of ways and, you know, using his off-ball movement and cutting and things he does really well, along with maybe a slightly higher peak and trajectory of his jump shot, if he can reach that. And then pairing that with just active defense that does enough, you know, to make sure he's not a complete liability, that mm-hmm. that hopefully he's a small plus. And I think that's the hope in the future with him.
Do you think one of the things that kind of stuck out to me is that it almost feels like the Mavericks are kind of caught between two eras here, right? You've got the power structure that's been there for years and years. Donnie Nelson and Rick Carlisle, they won the only title in Mavs history with the biggest superstar in Mavs history in Dirk Nowitzki. Now we've got the next big Mavs superstar in Luka Doncic. Things have changed in the front office, bringing in an analytic guy like Harlebob. So I'm kind of wondering, like, how does Dirk fit into this at this point? Because you mentioned in the piece that Luka kind of angled to get to Dallas. He has a relationship with Dirk. And honestly, Dirk was in a lot of the same scenarios that Luka was in, right? Early in his career, had some playoff disappointments. It took a long time till they finally got that title in 2011. In today's day and age, it wouldn't be surprising to see a Dirk Nowitzki-like character, the Luka, want to leave after this. Is Dirk in Luka's ear at all, being like, look, man, it's tough, but you're still early in your career. You haven't signed your second deal even yet. There's a lot of time in front of you here. Or is he kind of like, hey, man, it worked out for me. I'm not exactly sure if things are the same in 2021 as they were in 2011. The league has changed a lot. How is Luka and Dirk's relationship going to factor into all this?
It's definitely a factor in how Luka feels about Dallas. You know, that's something I put in the story, and it's something that I truly, you know, I believe, and I've been told that Luka does, you know, feel good about this franchise. He has a lot of goodwill. Obviously, there are specific relationships that he has with people in the team that need to improve or need to be, you know, managed or dealt with in a way that, you know, doesn't upset him or continue to frustrate him. But, you know, I do think that Dirk is a great factor. I think it's too soon to think that, you know, Dirk is in his ear about, you know, what to do next or patience or anything like that. You know, Luka is happy, you know, like he is satisfied. He wants to win. You know, he's not happy with losing. He's never been. And, you know, this is but he's preparing to sign the Supermax contract. I don't even think, you know, I didn't report this in the story and for a good reason. I don't. As far as I know, I don't believe, and sources say this is not at all what he's trying to do. He's not trying to leverage, you know, his power. You know, he's obviously a person that the team thinks and frames every decision around. But, you know, if he had been personally wanting to, you know, kind of play power games himself, like, why would he say that he was just going to sign the extension on at the exit interview and yeah. be like, you know, somebody asked him and he said, you know, I think you know what the answer is, and, you know, did it with a smile. And, you know, it wasn't a situation where he's like, we'll see. And you know, then he can come to Mark and Mark Cuban and talk, you know, like, I want this player. I want this person gone. I want this person as my coach, et cetera. Yeah. You know, so I don't think that's what he's trying to do. I don't think that's the situation he's in. But as it relates to Dirk, like, there's only one Dirk. Measuring people to Dirk is not the, you know, it's impossible. You know, that's not a standard, you know, that's a standard he's set, you know, in like a different plateau or a different, you know, reality that it just isn't realistic to even expect players to, you know, want to emulate or model. And so, you know, where Dirk was patient and where Dirk was someone who waited, I think just the reality of any superstar, whether it's Luka or not, they'll look at situations, and if they're not satisfied with the amount of winning with their team or with the power structures around them that they have to deal with constantly, those are things that will frustrate them, and they know that they're able to move on to situations that they'll appreciate and enjoy better.
Well, it's a fantastic article that you and Sam put together here, Tim. It's called Inside the Mavericks Front Office, Mark Cuban's Shadow GM is Causing a Rift with Luka Doncic. Again, headline, spot on. Artwork, amazing. And then the words, yeah. Even better. Tim, what's the easiest way for people to get in touch with you, to talk to you, to ask you questions maybe about the article? I assume by way of Twitter, is that right?
Yeah, I'd say Twitter's probably easiest, you know. I think that's the one. I've got open DMs. People can tweet me. I'm Tim_Cato, so just follow me there.
Oh, I'd like to see some of those open DMs right now, Tim. Oh. I'm sure there's a few angry ones that have come your way too in the last 24
hours. I just make my AI reply to those.
Well, Tim, we've kept you long enough. We'll let you go, man. Thank you so much for swinging by on such short notice. We really appreciate it. I've also heard you on like 3 or 4 other podcasts, and you're bringing it on every single one. So thank you so much, man.
Thank you, guys.
All right. Take care, Tim. Oh, fantastic. Go check that out. Go to theathletic.com/nodunks if you don't have yourself an Athletic subscription, and go read that article. And then, well, then you've got a subscription. You can read all the articles that you have over at The Athletic, especially in the NBA world that we focus on. Had some other news last night, guys. Rudy Gobert, Ben Simmons, both unanimous selections to the NBA's all-defensive first team for the 2021 season. They were joined by Draymond Green and Giannis at forward, as well as Jrue Holiday to round out the backcourt. All-defensive second team was led by Bam Adebayo and Kawhi Leonard as your forwards. Joel Embiid as the big man in the middle, and then Jimmy Butler and Matisse Thybulle as the two guards. And I'll throw this up there. I should have done it while I was talking there, but there's a look for everybody in the stream team and joining us live or a little bit later on YouTube. So you can look at the numbers, you can dissect them. Task, does anything jump out at you? Do you think the voters did an okay job? Any questions with this? And I guess you can get into omissions too if you're really upset. But what do you think about the all-defensive teams?
Sexy names. Really big, big names here on these all-defensive squads. If you look up and down, I think that's what jumps out to me at first. A lot of big names.
Yeah.
And I think it's a really, really, really well-done voting job. You can parse. I think Jimmy Butler, although he has the name, again, I think there's a lot of name recognition here. I think Mikal Bridges may have done a better job this season in terms of games played because Jimmy missed some time, and been a better defensive player this year. But you're asking voters to really do a lot of work to really understand who was the better defensive player this year. So I think that would be my one rewrite. Even though Matisse Thybulle didn't play a ton and in terms of minutes played, on the lower end of the spectrum of guys who've made it historically, he's still so good and already developed the name in those minutes. He is historically good. So I think he is entirely fine there.
Okay. Lee, any problems with these two all-defensive teams?
No, we got really good representation though from teams. Two from the Bucks, two from the Heat, and three from the Sixers. Yeah, so if you've got a good defensive team, you've got a lot of good defensive players in there. I just like the fact there's five internationals as well and two Australians. Matisse Thybulle technically qualifies for Australia there. So, but overall, yeah, this was one of those ones where it was like, man. The voters seem to have gotten it pretty accurate here. I do agree. I thought Jimmy Butler probably got in on a reputation there because I just didn't think he played enough this season.
But some people think that's the same with Kawhi, too.
Still. Yeah, I think so. I think Kawhi, because he's a two-time defensive player of the year, Kawhi's like, when he decides to, there's no question he's one of the best, but he does seem to go through a lot of the season just like, I'm not going to be all defensive Kawhi Leonard tonight, but when he does lock in, for sure. So, I really didn't have any complaints. I thought they were well chosen there. Just great to see Simo in there with the unanimous pick because he was probably, he did finish runner-up actually, didn't he, for defensive player of the year. So, great to see Simo. Good on you, son.
Any observations with these teams, Trey? I know you're not. You hate defense. I feel like bad asking you.
No, I need to stick up for the small markets here. How come the Lakers and the Knicks don't have any players on these all-defense teams? These are two top five defenses. Nobody showing up basically in any of the voting. I just thought that's kind of unusual, but that probably just helps a Tom Thibodeau or a Frank Vogel coach of the year kind of case, right? Getting everybody on the same page. And obviously, Anthony Davis probably would have made an all-defense team if he played a little bit more. The other takeaway from this is that big guys are better at defense than small guys. First team has 2 7-footers, a small ball 5, and a 6'10" point guard. Second team has 2 more centers. So if you throw in Matisse Thybulle's arms, that's maybe another 7-footer there. So yeah, it turns out being big out there helps you play defense.
I think Ziller brought this point up in his newsletter this morning too. This might sort of, in the breakdown of the voting here, where who's getting put in center positions and forward positions, I'm talking about Joel Embiid. He's not on the All-NBA first team. That might mean he will not be on the All-NBA first team too, even though you could make him a forward. So it could be Jokic and Embiid both on your All-NBA first team. But if the voters sort of follow suit like they did here with the all-defensive teams, maybe we see Embiid as the All-NBA second team center. Do you know what I'm saying there? Did that make sense to you? Because it barely made any sense to me. But Ziller did a great job of breaking it down in his newsletter.
Well, yeah. Get rid of positions and then we don't have to worry about it. So
I mean, but it is sort of funny like that Bam is considered a forward. I mean, people were like, well, got to get him in my top 10 defensive guys. So they're like, well, he's a forward. But he's not. I mean, he's a center. No. He's really a center on that team. Anyway, I don't have many qualms with this. There are some like classic like throwaway votes, if you want to call them that, that'll leave you like scratching your head, like, you know, Russell Westbrook, I think, got a vote. And there are a couple other names where you're like, what? You're not watching games. Like, I don't know what you're doing here. Does it ultimately matter? No, because for the most part, there's like enough separation when you're building these teams, like that your dumb throwaway vote for someone that's definitely not an all-defensive player doesn't matter. But still, I don't know how you feel about that task when people do that. Is it because they're just literally so clueless, these voters that are voting for them, or is it because they're friends with the agent? I don't know what it is. Like, what's the reason? It's not great, though. It's not a good look, these dumb throwaway votes, in my opinion.
Yeah, I don't know what it is either. It's not a good look. I guess. I guess the nerds get into it. The NBA sickos get into it. But at the end of the day, does anybody really notice?
Nope.
No,
it do not matter. Yeah, it's weird that Russell Westbrook got a vote. I'm seeing that Dennis Schroeder did get a first team vote, but for the most part, people are seeing this on a TV show and they're getting a graphic and they're seeing 10 names on there, and nobody cares that Russell Westbrook got a first team vote. But if you're a sicko, it is pretty weird.
Mm. Wow, did Westbrook get a first team?
I don't know if he got a first team vote.
My God, that's really bad. I mean, it's one thing with the second team because you're like, okay. People I don't even think know. The casual fan doesn't even know we have an all-defensive second team, probably. But first team, that's a little too far. Anyway, let's hear your biggest omissions. Mikal Bridges is a great one. I think he was, like, right there. I think he just sort of missed the cut of sneaking in there. But with these things, we said it before, especially all-defensive teams, you gotta, like, it's the little groundwork. You need that, like, you need the sickos to be like, hey, where's Bridges? He's an awesome defender. And that will likely then seep into next year's voting. He'll probably continue to be a good defender. He'll probably become even a better defender. More people will notice. His team's obviously having some success in the Suns, going far in the playoffs. And I will, like, lock it in now. Mikal Bridges will be on one of the all-defensive teams next year. It's sort of just like this little momentum happens, and he'll get in there. But Matisse Thybulle, for barely playing, is pretty impressive. Only 20 minutes per game. I think it's the lowest minutes per game played by an all-defensive player ever. All-defensive team player, I should say, Lely. Just pretty,
he's a great defender,
wild.
Though.
Yeah, I know.
Long-armed, moves his feet well, gets into position well. Like that is really like a watch him. You've got to watch him to appreciate how good he is at defense. So it is funny that he gets in, and so does Jimmy Butler, because that's the thing. Jimmy is kind of like, he's always a good defender. Just throw him on there. But yeah.
But you're okay with it with Thybulle? I mean, he doesn't play half the game, half the game. So, I mean, you can see the argument, at least. Like, there are guys out there.
Well, he's claiming he's Australian, which was news to me.
He can.
So
he can play for Australia.
Okay.
No, I think in terms of as a defender, I think he's a great defender in that limited time. But does he deserve to be on the all defense for that? Well, yes, there's definitely an argument there. But I'm glad to see he got the recognition, at least, for when he is out there, because I think he's fantastic as a perimeter and a movement defender. Like he rarely gets sort of caught because he can move so well. So, and he's got the long arms, which help.
But it's a strange thing, that he plays 20 minutes per game and gets on there. But at the same time, it's not like an offensive player who has per 36 numbers who can't play 36 minutes. Like his numbers would just go up generally. His numbers would just be better. And he is, Seth Partnow broke it down. He is averaging 4% steal rate and 5% block rate. So, those numbers, he joins a select list of Akeem, David Robinson, Nerlens Noel, Kim Hughes, and Bobby Jones. Guys you don't necessarily think of. And the minutes, if he played 82 games, he'd play more than some guys that have made it, like a Tony Allen or Avery Bradley or Andre Kirilenko in some seasons. So, he's going to, he averaged 2 blocks and 2 steals per 36 minutes. Those numbers would go up if he played, but just got to get a shot, and he could play a little bit more. That's all he's going to be working on this offseason. Less of the editing that he worked on in the bubble, which he was really good at.
He was
very good at editing his experience. Man, he was really good.
Want him shooting threes in the offseason, sure. Yeah. Go ahead, Trey.
I was going to say, good luck keeping Matisse away from making art.
Oh, nice. All right. On that note, let's take our final break before we get to Tweet of the Night. All right, let's wrap this bad boy up with a little Tweet of the Night.
Tweet of the Night. Wow.
Twitter. Yes, we're playing it pretty fast and loose today because I had a bunch of different options, one of which involved
all of the Batmans through history and whether or not they did a particular sex act. You can check my Twitter feed for that one. That's from a from at Whitney Puppy. But you know what? We're running long, and so what I'm going to do is I'm just going to go way back. This is a random tweet from 2012 from a guy named David Burge.
What?
And it says, Soft Focus Lens Hall of Fame, Penthouse, the magazine from 1974 to 78, Dynasty Era, Linda Evans, soap opera flashback scenes, Barbara Walters and Bob Costas. He forgot Cybill Shepherd, but I would like to add one more to the Hall of Fame. That's our very own Tim Cato, who was, unfortunately, he was on a borrowed laptop, a backup laptop. He apologized for it over Slack after the show. Shout out to Tim. It was a great segment. And, you know, it's very... what's the word? It's ethereal where he is. It's kind of cool, but looking forward to having him back on the show with a new webcam.
All right, I was wondering where you were going with that tweet, but you brought it all together, Jamie. You're a master at it. Just a quick look ahead to tonight's Game 5. Only one game on tonight, guys. Wild Bucks Nets, pivotal game. Kyrie Onogo, Lele, James Harden upgraded from out to doubtful. At least he was at the start of this show. I don't know what's happened in the last hour or so. But who do you have winning tonight's game? What can we expect from Kevin Durant? How quickly will PJ Tucker be in foul trouble in this one? That's what everybody wants to know.
This is a monster game, really, for the Bucks, because they may not get a better chance to put the Nets on the ropes. I mean, if James Harden doesn't play, then you think he's probably a certainty to play Game 6 if the Bucks win tonight, I would guess. So Milwaukee will not get a better chance to sort of recover from what was a disastrous first two games. And I think if we have downhill Giannis attacking the paint, going at the sort of weak interior there of the Nets, I think that's the best chance for the Bucks to win. But Kevin Durant, do we see a potential LeBron Game 6 against the Celtics from 2012 game? Does he just decide, listen, I have to do it all tonight? Almost play point forward Kevin Durant, you know, score 40, maybe get a dozen assists or so, and hope some guys like, Joe Harris hits threes. What's his name? Mike James to hit some threes. I mean, I think that if I'm Steve Nash, I'm probably like, Kevin, just play point forward Kevin Durant and see if they can stop you, because I don't think PJ Tucker can run with you. I think when it's a physical sort of like encounter, that's PJ's best chance to slow him down. Run a ton of screens and just see if we can get a freakish Kevin Durant performance, because I think they need that, because Joe Harris is probably their second best player right now. He hasn't had a great series. They need someone to get going. So, but again, I think the emphasis is entirely on Milwaukee tonight. I think you're basically at full strength. You have to go out there and put the Nets in a position where they can be eliminated for the Game 6 in Milwaukee.
If I'm Steve Nash, and come on, close enough, right? I would play. I would play myself tonight. Can he legally do that if there's no Kyrie and Harden? Can Steve Nash just insert himself into the starting lineup, play some point guard minutes, you know, alleviate some of the pressure there off KD? But Tass, you're on record. You think the Nets can still win this game. You said that with the idea that there will be no Kyrie and no Harden. Again, Harden is a possibility here as we get closer and closer. But do you still believe that? Are we going to see something special here from KD? That's what it feels like you're thinking.
Yeah, definitely. They won 4 of 5 games when Kevin Durant played solo this season without James Harden and Kyrie Irving. So they know how to play. They have a bunch of guys to play around him. Joe Harris has had 2 bad games in a row. I think they're going to look for him early and often. Kevin Durant, by his standards, has had 2 bad games in a row. And so I expect, this team to really rally around and play at home. Again, that's really important. I think James Harden is going to test that hamstring pregame, as Adrian Wojnarowski reported, and give it a go and see how it feels. That's a testament to James Harden being a throwback guy, trying to play every single game if he's not injured. Doubtful, but still going to go out there and give it his all, and at least be, if he is out there, a gravity puller. Everybody will be looking at him on the floor, and that's the problem when it's, Kevin Durant and Joe Harris and all the other guys on those slim contracts. It's everybody looking at KD and loading up on him. But the fact that they had that second half with just Kevin Durant and no Kyrie Irving and James Harden in Game 4, I think gave him a little little test for what's going to happen here. And those guys, I think they're going to make shots at home. So, I'm guessing that they get everybody involved and the home court gets them to the finish line in this one.
Yeah, the stream team dropping the Durant over-under tonight, TK, at 45.5. Would you go over or under if that was the actual line? That's the stream team's line for Kevin Durant tonight.
I'm going under, but I would need to get a line as well on assists because I'm probably going over on assists. I think KD could still go for maybe a 40 and maybe something like 10 assists. So give me a line of 8.5 assists. Okay. I'm going over because the Nets got to hit some threes because no doubt the Bucks are going to be loading up on Giannis. PJ Tucker will get the assignment, but there's a little bit more lingering wiggle room for Giannis to be hanging around the rim and for Brook Lopez to be hanging around the rim. So it's going to be on Jeff and Joe and Mike to make some threes out here. Landry's got to make some threes. I think they only made 18 total playing in Milwaukee. And obviously the Nets are one of the best offensive teams that we've seen. Usually that's with a second superstar alongside him. Maybe that's James Harden. And maybe James Harden just becomes a spot up shooter tonight, which would help the Nets immensely. So give me the under on points, the over on assists for Kevin Durant. It feels like there's equal amounts of pressure on both teams here, right? Like, we got to see, everybody's expecting a LeBron-style game from Kevin Durant, but like Lee's saying, the Bucks almost have to win this one, especially if Harden isn't able to go, and even if he is, he's going to be a little bit compromised. So you got to think that from a momentum standpoint and from a health standpoint, the Bucks have the upper hand here, but if they go into Brooklyn and lose this one to an undermanned Nets team, people are going to be ready to say the Bucks are going home again.
Very excited for Game 5 tonight. Bucks-Nets. I believe it's an 8:30 p.m. Eastern start, and we'll figure out what that actually means as we get closer to it, and we'll find out whether or not Harden's actually playing, whether he gives that hamstring a go. Thank you so much to Tim Cato for coming on the show. Again, go check out that article inside the Mavericks front office there. There it is. We're showing the stream team now. Go to theathletic.com/NoDunks to get your Athletic subscription if you don't already. Subscribe to No Dunks on YouTube. Send in your questions and comments for Beach, Step, and Still, NoDunks@TheAthletic.com, or tweet them in at No Dunks Inc. And we'll be back tomorrow with, two shows, because we'll have the morning show recapping tonight's game and any other NBA news, and then we'll hit the beach later in the afternoon. Clipper Bros.
You heard it here first. Have a great time. Turn up. Love you guys. Awesome.
Thanks for joining us, and remember, every time I see Tim Cato's name, I think Calvin Cato. Remember Calvin Cato?
I do. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Me too.
Embrace the day, people. You could stay.